Welcome to Reading the Grid with Erin and Ina. Each week, we explore the stories behind books, movies, and shows that highlight the history of this dynamic sport. Buckle up for a fast-paced journey through Formula One. Now let's jump into it. This week, we turn our spotlight to the historic Imola Circuit, which delivered a race brimming with strategic depth, audacious overtakes, and emotional highs. Max Verstappen showcased his racing prowess with a bold move at the very first corner, overtaking pole sitter Oscar Piastri at the Tamburello chicane. This decisive action set the tone for the race, allowing Verstappen to control the pace and ultimately secure victory in Red Bull's 400th Grand Prix appearance.
This race may have been the last one at Imola, as it is not scheduled to return in 2026, and there are no plans to put it back on Formula One calendar in the near future. In the past couple of years, the consensus among F1 fans seemed to be that Imola does not produce exciting races, as the track is too narrow for the current class of cars. However, the just-concluded Imola Grand Prix was a masterclass in tire strategy. Teams grappled with challenging balance between speed and durability, making the timing of pit stops crucial. Verstappen staying out on medium tires paid off, although he also had the luck and benefit of the virtual safety car for a tire change. The second safety car closed the gap between him and resurgent Lando Norris to about 6 seconds.
Starting from 12th on the grid, Lewis Hamilton delivered a standout performance for Ferrari, finishing fourth. His charge through the field was aided by strategic pit stops and a well-timed safety car, marking his best result since joining the Scuderia.
The race wasn't without its controversies. Charles Leclerc, after being instructed to yield a position to Alex Albon due to an earlier incident, expressed his frustration over team radio, highlighting the intense emotions and split-second decisions that define F1.
As the championship battle intensifies, Verstappen narrows the gap to leader Piastri to only 22 points, with Norris very close behind. This season promises more excitement ahead. Stay tuned as we delve deeper into the strategies, performances, and implications of the Imola Grand Prix in today's episode. Ina, who won your heart in Imola?
There was not one obvious suspect for me, since the drivers who were able to move up and execute amazing moves benefited from the safety cars. If I had to pick one person, it would be Isaac Hadjar, as he was the standout of the rookies. And even though he did not benefit from the safety cars, he was able to retain his starting position of ninth. Alex Albon had a great race, despite his tussle with Leclerc. I do not think cost him the podium, especially since Ferrari asked Leclerc to give the position back.
I'd agree with you there. I don't think that messed with him at all with the podium chances.
I actually think what won my heart the most was the choice by Pirelli of bringing softer tires, which forced two-stop strategies. And that is the best thing that could have happened in Imola. Although I do not have many superlatives to dish out to Ferrari, I am appreciative that they split the strategy between Lewis and Charles by having them start on hard and mediums respectively, which is what I have been asking Ferrari to do from the beginning of our podcast. And I also want to say it was a masterstroke to have Leclerc undercut his competition before it all went horribly wrong with the safety car. What about you, Erin?
My obvious answer is Lewis Hamilton. Even though he was stuck behind his Mercedes replacement and the town favorite Kimi Antonelli for way too long, he had some really great overtakes, finally getting around Kimi, his former teammate George Russell, and his current teammate Charles, even though Albon helped with that quite a bit. He seemed to be more comfortable in the car and actually said it was the first time he felt as one with the car as possible. So to see him have a charging race was very reminiscent of what we're used to seeing from Hamilton, which we haven't seen since him joining Ferrari. I'm still not going to give this to my driver because he doesn't need to win my heart week over week. He already has it.
I just want to say, in terms of his overtakes, they were impressive. However, it's always easier to overtake when you have DRS and there's a tire strategy that favors you because you have newer tires. That is why I think the most impressive overtake of the whole Grand Prix for me was Max Verstappen in turn one, because it was masterful, because he managed to place his car so that neither Russell nor Lando Norris could get in to tussle with him. And then he just sent it because the pace advantage wasn't there at the very beginning. I thought that was the most impressive overtake.
Hands down, that was perfectly executed. It was by far one of the best overtakes I've seen in a race in a really long time. He committed and it was flawless. He definitely deserved driver of the day. Great minds think alike, because Isaac Hadjar also won my heart. He continues to impress me throughout this entire season. He had a well-fought race after a not so great qualifying session because he did bring out the red flag. I was glad he started in the points. He started and finished ninth, got 2 points for Racing Bulls, had a difficult start, lost 2 places, but the team executed a strong race strategy and good tire management. He briefly was up in P7, and then the safety car that impacted his race. So, despite these setbacks, overall, I was pretty pleased with his performance and the team's efforts.
We're talking about his ninth place qualifying as not the most successful, whereas his teammate Liam Lawson, where was he? He also supposedly had an issue with qualifying, being cut short due to the red flag, but let's be honest, he's nowhere near Hadjar. And I think, again, just because Williams are doing heroics, which we'll get into later, doesn't that mean that what Racing Bulls with Hadjar are pulling out ninth is very impressive? And I, for one, think he did an outstanding job even in qualifying.
I agree. I was so hopeful that he was actually going to not have to call out the safety car. He almost got to track and then beached himself. So there was a glimmer of hope that, he'd continue on. So overall, though, I thought he did a great job and he has consistently outperformed Liam, who is no favorite of either one of ours. So, no love lost there.
Liam had a new mustache this Grand Prix. I don't think it helped.
Clearly not. If we're going to talk about lost loves or broken hearts, Fernando Alonso totally broke mine this race. I thought this was going to be the race where the two-time champ finally finished in the points. Aston was showing some promising signs with their gamble to go with the medium tire and qualifying. The one that really crushed me, though, is Oscar Piastri. I thought McLaren had made some bad strategy calls for him with his pit stop. When they released him, he got stuck in so much traffic, although he did make his way back through. I hated that he went from pole, missed breaking the record with 4 wins in a row, but for him to land on the podium, I thought was really deserved after a hard-fought race. What about you?
Just to mention about Oscar Piastri, I did think that McLaren overreacted to how successful Leclerc's undercut was. Again, for the first time ever, Ferrari did one thing right. And some teams panicked, which was to their detriment, because of course, we all know about the safety cars. But we'll get to that in a second,
Yes.
because I just want to go back to Alonso.
Sure.
So his radio calling the race torture and saying that he had the worst luck in the effing world struck a chord, especially as he now has a brother in the worst luck department, and that is, of course, Charles Leclerc. So my heart broke during qualifying when both Ferrari failed to get out of Q2. This is the first time in the history of Ferrari that it happened at Imola, which is one of their home races. We will talk about Ferrari in more detail a little later, but another one that broke my heart is, of course, the homeboy, Kimi Antonelli, who's from Bologna, a stone's throw away from Imola, brought his entire schoolmate class to, first of all, be in Mercedes gear, which I think is pretty impressive in the land of Ferrari.
For sure.
And then proceeded to completely devolve into like a version of himself that I barely recognize. One of the things that really struck with me is how poor his qualifying was after he finally made such a leap forward in Miami, being on pole for the sprint in P3 in the main race, out-qualifying George Russell. So the expectation was he's going to continue to build on that. I think he got too excited. Toto wasn't at the race. Maybe that had something to do with it. But in any case, his qualifying was abysmal. He even went behind our boys. Then his race was completely undone by Mercedes' horrible strategy and the fact that his car proved to be unreliable, forcing a safety car that was the nail in the coffin of Leclerc's recovery drive. In fact, both safety cars broke my heart as they undermined the strategy of drivers who had incredible drives.
I don't know if you saw the stats. So the last time a new pope was elected, Kimi Räikkönen won Imola. So I had a little hopium since Pope Leo was announced that Kimi Antonelli would make your prediction come true that he would win a Grand Prix. I mean, how cool would that have been if he won his home race? And it was really heartbreaking to see him get taken out in qualifying and DNF in the race. That was so sad.
Yeah. And I also want to say that, remember, this is one of two. He still has Monza, although, I have my favorites for that one too. But he can still win his home race. So this is just strike one. Speaking of strikes, so in Q1, we had a horrible crash of Yuki Tsunoda. It was actually one of the most horrific in recent memory. And when shown in replay, because initially all we saw was a car in the barriers, but we didn't see how much it flipped and how horrible it actually was. And the fact that Yuki walked away from it seemingly without any damage, first of all, extremely lucky. And I feel it's extremely prescient that we just released an episode reviewing Rush, where we talked about all the safety measures that have been put in place since the horrific Niki Lauda accident from 1976. And one of those innovations was Halo. And I think Halo is really the innovation that helped Yuki survive this crash without any lasting damage.
Agreed. I very similar to you. I saw the car against the barrier. I'm like, oh, okay, that can't be bad. But my breath stopped when I watched the replay and realized how many times he flipped and how bad it was, especially when you heard the other drivers immediately going, is he okay? I just watched the video. That looked really bad. Thank goodness for those safety measures like the halo that keep the driver safe. There's a number of those. Since 2018, Romain Grosjean, Hamilton, Yuki, a number of them where it gave them the ability to walk away from those accidents. We renamed a segment here because, as everyone knows, we're both Ferrari fans. So we'd like to welcome you to Scuderia Shenanigans here on Reading the Grid. This is going to be our dedicated space for all things Ferrari, whether it's brilliance, heartbreak, or a bit of both. As proud passengers on the Ferrari Hopium train, we're going to unpack every strategic gamble, pit stop panic, and glimmer of Leclerc and Hamilton magic, because when it comes to the prancing horse, it's never just a race. It's a full-blown emotional saga. So let's dive in, Nina.
Well, I just want to say I'm only a Ferrari fan as long as Leclerc is there. So once he leaves, I might leave the roller coaster of emotions that I go through every race with Ferrari behind me. And I can't wait for that day because I just need some peace and quiet and just some reliability, which is not what Ferrari train provides.
Listen, I was the Mercedes fan because of Hamilton. This is my first year as a Ferrari fan, and this is a doozy.
Really? After seeing the Mercedes strategy blunders over the weekend, I don't think you would be, you probably would be in the same boat as you are now with Ferrari.
At least the car seems more consistent at Mercedes than Ferrari this year.
I don't know. It was really good at Miami. What the hell happened in race pace in Imola? But
Fair.
anyway,
They switched, but regardless.
back to Ferrari. After
Yes.
having my heart broken in qualifying, it lifted when Leclerc started coming through the field in the race and for once seemed to be a beneficiary of decent strategy at Ferrari. And by the way, before his infamous undercut, I loved his tussle with Gasly because at that moment, I think you saw Leclerc's inner bastard come out. And I mean, Gasly should not have even tussled, but that's beside the point. The point is Leclerc's like, okay, dude, I love you in life, But on this racetrack, I'm going through and I don't care what you do. After the undercut, I was high on hoping, which was completely undone by the safety cars. So first, the virtual safety cars caused by Ocon, who decided to grow out his hair. I think he should cut it because this is not working. But anyway, of course, Ferrari had to give up Leclerc's track position and pit him again, which I guess I get why they did it, but I wish they didn't because maybe that would have differentiated in the strategy. I don't think so, but we can always hope. And then, of course, it gave free pit stops to the drivers that have not pitted yet, which included Lewis Hamilton and the biggest beneficiary of all, Max Verstappen, who, as usual, didn't really need all that luck, but he still got it. And then there was a physical safety car, which was caused by my boy, Kimi Antonelli. And Ferrari did not think that they had tires that could last the rest of the race. What I think Ferrari forgot is that the safety car would last a few laps. So just because they didn't think he could go 17 laps on the soft, the actual racing period was 10 laps. And maybe he could. He probably couldn't. But I just wish there was, more proactive discussion about that. As usual, there were glimmers after the disaster that it was qualifying. There were glimmers of hope. And then, of course, in the true Ferrari fashion, they were very much dashed.
Completely. Qualifying was a disaster. I was shocked that they both had new sets of tires on in Q2, did not gain any positions. And then when Aston made the gamble to go on mediums and bumped them both, I was stunned that Charles nor Lewis made it to Q3. Charles seemed to have a very unlucky race, and I did not quite understand his team strategy calls. Although I was thinking to myself as I was watching it, Ina's going to be happy they finally split strategies, but she's not going to love that it didn't necessarily benefit Charles. What baffled me more was that tire situation at the end when he made the call for softs. And I could not believe that because I feel like we should have an award for their most unique radio messages. It's really something special. But the good thing is, both Ferrari drivers showed pace. They gained a number of places. Both finished in the points from starting 11th and 12th, which was way more than I expected in qualifying. So, overall, they made a bit of redemption with the Tifosi at home after a disastrous qualifying.
Well, I also like the fact that Fred Vasseur in the post-race interview did say that he gave a lot of credit to the drivers for where they ended up, which I think was important because
Yes, for sure.
after qualifying, both Lewis and Charles were not very complimentary towards the car. And Fred Vasseur kept saying, "Oh no, we have potential." And I'm like, "You have amazing drivers. They'll tell you there's no more potential. Why don't you not contradict them? That would be something." But I felt the fact that he gave them credit was definitely a step in the right direction. Charles, as he said in his radio, never has the luck of freaking safety cars. And even though Ferrari split the strategies, which again is something I think they should keep doing until they are title contenders. Because obviously the strategy department sucks. So the best thing they can do is try different things and see what works. But I also think if there was no virtual safety car, I don't know if Lewis would have gotten as far as he did. So he was a definitely a beneficiary of that, which is good for him. But what
Which
I'm
is
saying is,
unusual.
well, not for Lewis. I think the
Oh,
only.
do you remember? Like, it's hit
Yes,
or
wait.
miss. It's
Okay,
hit or
people, take a
miss.
drink.
It
We're
is,
gonna
take a
go Abu
drink. I
Dhabi
didn't actually
2020.
say it.
We
I
all knew where he
alluded
was going.
to.
Okay, but I'm telling you, I honestly can't think of one race where Leclerc benefited from a safety car. Not one.
No, I can't either, to be honest.
I mean, technically, you can say, like, even if you think of Monaco 2024, my greatest memory. It was a red flag, not a safety car, where allowed him to switch tires as everyone else, and so he could go on for the rest of the race without switching tires, which caused the whole problem of Monaco being a procession. But I honestly, seriously, like, you have to really rack your brain to find anything that helped him ever with the safety cars.
No, he definitely needs a good luck charm or something to reverse his racing luck. For sure.
Not everything happens at the front of the pack. We shine a light on the teams fighting it out in the most competitive part of the grid. From surprising strategy plays to quiet consistency, we break down who's punching above their weight and who's getting lost in the shuffle. Because sometimes the best racing isn't necessarily for P1, and sometimes it's not even racing that makes it exciting. I'll give you example number one, LP. Or, as I call it, as the Alpine world turns. The drama that preceded the race was intoxicating. In the space of a few days, we had all of the following happen. As we predicted last time, Jack Doohan was out and Franco Colapinto was in. Whew! The Alpine press release mentioned that he would only be in for five races on a rotation basis. Keep that in mind, it'll come up again. Then, Oliver Oakes resigned. Supposedly for personal reasons, which nobody believed when it initially came out, and everyone thought it was a protest against mistreatment of Jack Doohan, which I thought was full of, it was not it. And apparently I was right, because then it looked like it was a reaction to having Oliver Oakes' brother arrested for suspected money laundering. I'll let you make your own conclusion, but let's not forget that Oliver Oakes is tied to the Mazepins. And the rumors were he was hiding in Dubai. However, when we got to Imola, Oliver Oakes showed up to support his high-tech team in Formula 2 and Formula 3, and he reconnected with Doohan, who is now reserved for Alpine. So the whole saga has so many layers and subplots. We'll keep following that. Not to be undone, Flavio Briatore was named a temporary team principal. The only problem is he does not have the required license to be
I
an
thought he
official
was
team principal.
executive advisor, right?
No, they specifically said he will assume Oliver Oakes' duties as team principals, but he could not be named team principal because, yes, he's not an employee of Alpine, he's just the consultant. And just to add more fire to the already inflammable situation. In the Sky interview pre-race, he was very adamant that Franco Colapinto does not have just five races, that he's in for the rest of the season, and he did not know where these rumors came from. Hilariously, they came from the Alpine press release. So, yeah, that's just the tip of the iceberg of everything that's going on in Alpine.
Listen, I'm all for a good paddock villain or two, but I'm really having a difficult time accepting Flavio being back in F1, let alone in the
Just
capacity that
remember,
he's in.
he was cleared and he served his suspension that ended in 2013. And he never admitted to any wrongdoing. Shocker. Also, he was very successful when he was team principal of Renault, which is the predecessor team to Alpine. So, from a very cynical point of view, I see why you would want him to still be in charge and get the team where it wants to be.
I just have such a hard time. I think this comes down to my overall standard of the sport. You have such high standards. How do you really let him back in?
You don't understand. Formula One has always had these characters. It's always had corruption. Anytime you have such big money, things are going to happen. You have Jean Haas, by the way, in the paddock. I didn't realize he was allowed out of the country, but okay, who has a whole fraud past. So does Flavio Briatore, although he never served jail time, unlike Jean.
Well, that's true. But Gene's white collar crime were not tied to F1, correct?
Well, just because he didn't get to F1 at that point, but I'm sure it wouldn't have stopped him if he decided to do some fraud.
Yeah, but my point is, like, Flavio's issue happened within F1. He orchestrated a crash to help another driver. I don't know. It doesn't give me the warm and fuzzies having him back.
Look, I agree with you. And if Alpine starts to win everything, then we'll have a problem. But seeing how it's so dysfunctional and how many issues they have, the only thing is I have to say, Pierre Gasly must have, I mean, he's gone through the Red Bull disaster. So he obviously is very mentally strong because to keep above Frey with all of that going on must be tough.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think about that side of it.
Yeah. No wonder he was like, Leclerc, you're not gonna, I'm not gonna let you through. I just need something to salvage my weekend.
Yeah, probably so.
Well, which is, I think, like the only thing that ever happened for poor Pierre is that at one point when he and Frank Colapinto were at the back of the grid, there were team orders for them to switch positions, and Colapinto immediately followed orders, and Gasly thanked him. And I thought, like, that is the one thing that went right for Pierre the whole weekend. Speaking of Franco Colapinto, he had one directive: do not crash. Guess what he did? He crashed in qualifying, even after he already made it to Q2. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to participate in Q2 because he destroyed the car. And that, I think, destroyed his confidence because he was so tentative in the race when they showed replays of cars just passing him by and him like not making or even trying any moves. I just felt really bad for him because he's like, if I crash it one more time, I might not even live to see the fifth race of my tenure.
Oh, I get that. Although it was actually very nice in the formation lap how gracious and thankful he was to the team for the amount of time that they had to put in to get the car race ready. I thought that was pretty classy of him to do that.
Just remember, he's not in Williams last year, where the mechanics, every crash, mechanics looked like they were losing their will to live because the crashes just kept coming. Whereas in Alpine, if you remember last season, Pierre never had a crash.
I know.
So the mechanics obviously did an amazing job to get that car ready, but I also think they're not as taxed as some other garages.
That's fair. Fair statement. There was a bit of drama on from practice on Friday, though, when Franco Colapinto unintentionally blocked Yuki Tsunoda in practice, prompting online abuse towards Tsunoda. Colapinto quickly condemned the hate, urging fans to stay respectful and reminding them that such behavior is, quote unquote, is not our thing. Tsunoda acknowledged the abuse and suggested F1 may need to step in if it escalates. The incident has reignited concerns over toxic fan behavior in motorsport, and Alpine even issued a team statement on the matter.
Even FIA issued a statement on the matter.
Oh, they did. I didn't see that. They should.
Yes, they did. And unfortunately, Colapinto's fans, or a segment of his fans, have shown extremely toxic tendencies for a while now. They also hurled vitriol at Jack Doohan to such an extent that he actually had to hire security for the Miami Grand Prix, his last Grand Prix with the Alpine team for now. And there was also a fake story, and again, caused more threats to be leveled at Jack and his father. And it involved Jack and Alpine to issue statements to dispel all these rumors. I think it's getting a little out of control, and I can't really blame Colapinto for igniting such passion, but I do think Alpine and FIA should keep stepping in and taking it down a notch because that's unacceptable.
Oh, it's completely unacceptable. So I'm glad they're taking those steps, and hopefully his fans will get the message. Let's chat about Williams. Both Williams drivers were into the points. I was very hopeful that Albon would finally make the podium with a glimpse of him in P3. However, despite a second P5 finish in a row now for Williams, it was a bit of a disastrous race for Albon. He said in a post-race interview that it could have been better had he been a bit more patient when trying to overtake Leclerc. Carlos Sainz topped the team's points tally with his own solid run to eighth place. He did start ahead of Albon and lost out from a pre-virtual safety car pit stop. It is great to see Williams and their resurgence and what James Vowles has done to have two drivers operating at a similar level and pushing each other on.
Oh, it's amazing. And I have to say, Sainz coming from a high of being at the top of Q2 as the Ferraris are knocked out to completely undone by a strategy call, which again reacted to a Ferrari move. Okay, people stop reacting to Ferrari. It never works out for you.
Allah Red Bull.
Every time I find Leclerc behind Max, I'm like, just do what he does. Just follow, like, whatever you do. So I just want to mention, in terms of Albon, I have nothing against him. In fact, I like Alex, but I think his podium hopes were a lot of hopium. He had the tire advantage to get past Leclerc, so I absolutely think it would have happened no matter what. I think Leclerc got his inner bastard a little bit too worked up and should not have been involved in that incident. But the thing is, I don't think Albon would have gotten past Hamilton. Ferrari's had much better pace than Williams, and Hamilton was on as fresh tires as Albon. So I don't see in what universe Albon could have easily gotten past Hamilton to then overtake Piastri. There's just no way that could have happened. I'm glad he got P5 because I think that's amazing for a team that's the best of the rest. But I think in this race, that's as much as he could have hoped.
I'd say you're right. I think, you caught a glimpse of him in P3. He should have been on the podium twice before. He missed out because of Hamilton. So I can understand his desire and the fact that Williams is showing promise. They have 51 constructor points. They have majorly turned a page. So there's excitement building. They've got some momentum going. So I feel like it will happen this year, but it'll have to be some really extenuating circumstances for why you wouldn't have a Max and Oscar or Lando on a podium for a Williams to get in, because Ferrari and Mercedes are solidly ahead of Williams. But I would like to see a Williams on the podium at some point in this year.
I don't think it will happen this year because they're not bringing any upgrades for the rest of the year.
Well,
And
unless we have something crazy happen, I think there's usually a race on the calendar year where someone unexpected ends up on the podium. Last year, we had Pierre and Esteban on the podium. No one saw that coming. And I would like to see Albon on the podium before Sainz.
I'm with you. I'm all for Albon. I just don't think it will happen with this Williams. I think next year, great opportunity because they're going to have the Mercedes engine, which we know is going to be the best. And they're obviously working very hard on the car and they've made such strides that I believe it'll be competitive. I just ha find a hard time to believe it'll happen this year. But you're right, anything can happen.
People have to factor in luck and safety cars. Well, speaking of teams that have not had much luck, Aston Martin has not had a great year, but boy, did they go bold in qualifying with the medium tire gamble. And as much as I hated to see them bump the Ferraris, kudos to that attempt. However, the fact that they could not deliver in the race made it a bit more painful than necessary for Charles and Lewis. And for that, I'm a tad irritated with
Well,
Aston Martin for.
yeah, I agree. The medium tires during qualifying, because that was the soft tire last year, was a stroke of genius. And Mercedes saw that and copied that. And they gambled on Russell's last lap in Q3, which, by the way, was the last lap of all the laps of everyone. And for him to be P3 after it on medium tires, that was one of my favorite moments of Q3. However, what Aston forgot is that they didn't have any other clean medium tires, and their race pace on hards was atrocious. So I see why the gamble paid off, and they obviously brought upgrades, which usually for them means they're doing something horrible, but it worked in short term, did not pan out in or long term. But as devastating as the moment was for Ferraris to not make it to Q3, I think it was pretty brilliant to see that it was done on medium tires.
I was shocked. Like, I wish I could have seen my face. Maybe not, because I was so stunned when their pace improved so much on mediums and qualifying. I'm like, all right, Hamilton's out. There's no way they're going to bump Leclerc too. And then when he went out, I'm like, effing Aston Martin, but way to go. Like, at the same time, good for you all for trying something new and having it pay off. And hats off to Mercedes for copying and, George getting P3. That was great.
Not the right Mercedes, but yes, I agree with you on strategy.
Correct.
Another brother having the worst luck in the world is my perennial favorite, Oliver Bearman. His whole qualifying was undone by a red flag caused by Franco Colapinto's crash and Bearman's lap, which was his last lap in Q1, was deleted because it was deemed to not have finished before the red flag was called. Haas very rightly protested the entire thing, and the start of Q2 was delayed because FIA actually needed time to look into it. So we're all happy about that. But ultimately, they decided that the red flag notification, even though it did not show on Ollie's dash, was raised before he finished the lap. So the deletion of the lap was justified. And unfortunately, his remaining lap was only good for P19th. And there's really not much he could have done in the race because I firmly believe Haas was the worst car at Imola. So he didn't deliver much from there.
No, I felt really bad for Bearman. Overall, for Haas, that was a brutal race. Even though they are sixth in the Constructors' Championship, Bearman has had a couple tough races. He finished 17th this time because of a pit stop issue and the subsequent safety car intervention, how it impacted his strategy. Ocon retired due to a technical issue. So I don't know when this team's going to catch a break.
Why does this team, which is, by the way, a customer Ferrari team, cause such issues for Ferrari? That's what I want to know. Racing Bulls never cause an issue for Red Bull that is affecting their race. Now Haas freaking causes issues for Ferrari. Ocon, cut your hair. I swear, I think it's all in the hair.
Let's spill the grid. We're going to dish out all the off-track drama, spicy team radio moments, and behind-the-scenes chaos that makes Formula One more than just a race. From feuds and fashion to contract rumors and coded Instagram posts, if it's making waves in the paddock, we're spilling it here. So we already addressed the drama in Alpine, which was quite a bit. And despite fresh speculation about Christian Horner's potential sacking as Red Bull Racing team principal, both Horner and the team have firmly denied these claims. Horner insists he's fully committed to his future with Red Bull powertrains. Max Verstappen also dismissed the rumors, calling them meaningless, while internal changes like the departures of Adrian Newey and Jonathan Wheatley have fueled uncertainty. Red Bull maintains Horner's role is not under threat and remains under contract through 2030. Although personally, I'm not quite sure I buy all of it because, as we have seen time and time again, when there is smoke, there tends to be fire.
Agreed. And especially since Andrea Newey in his latest interview implied that everything surrounding the Horner scandal was the reason that he left the team, there have also been speculations that, of all people, Oliver Oakes would be replacing Christian Horner at Red Bull in the near future. But as we detailed during our discussion of Alpine, Oakes may have some other things to worry about.
Yeah, I don't think Oakes is going to be cleared for that Red Bull spot if Horner does leave, but you never know. Although you do have Zak Brown antagonizing Christian Horner with his tire water bottle, where he was poking fun at a serious issue, even though McLaren was cleared by the FIA for the use of their quite genius tire cooling system.
Yeah, I actually like that the pre-race coverage on Sky Sports kind of they asked Zak Brown if they could examine the tire system. And he's like, yeah, go ahead. And Bernie Collins was like, yeah, you can't see really anything from the outside. I'm like, well, that's why he said you could look at it, because obviously he's
Exactly.
not going to divulge the sauce. So sometimes our favorite sports, tennis and F1, come together, and it happened this weekend. There was an Italian Open Championship in Rome with the current Italian number one, Jannik Sinner, facing Carlos Alcaraz. Sinner lost, but he had the best quip during his runner-up speech, where he thanked his brother, who was at Imola for Formula One, instead of watching Sinner. I admire Sinner's brother's priorities. He will have other chances to watch his brother play, but he will not miss what could be the last Imola Formula One race ever.
Exactly. Kudos to his brother. I'd go to F1 over tennis, and I'm a huge tennis fan too.
By the way, I'm pretty sure he didn't go for a regular person experience. It was the Sinner experience where he used his brother's connections. But it's so funny because the Sinner's mother covered her face. She was embarrassed, but I thought it was very funny. That's a wrap on our Imola 2025 breakdown from Max's clinical move at turn one to the strategic chess match on the tire wear. This race was all about precision, patience, and a little late race panic. Norris kept the pressure on, Piastri missed his moment, and Hamilton quietly delivered one of Ferrari's best results of the season. Cue Aaron's cautious optimism. Meanwhile, Ina is still riding the emotional roller coaster that is Charles Leclerc's race weekend. Welcome to the insanity. As the championship battle tightens and Monaco looms with a two-stop twist, the season is shaping up to be anything but predictable.
Exactly, because no one predicted Charles Leclerc to drive his Ferrari through the McDonald's drive-thru on his way out of Imola on his way back home. Could you imagine?
No.
Well, thanks so much for hanging out with us. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an update.
Would also love to hear from you, whether it's your thoughts on today's episode, your suggestions for F1 books, shows, or movies to explore, or a shout out to a fellow brother for having the worst luck in the world. Connect with us on Instagram, YouTube, or X, or drop us an email at readingthegrid@gmail.com. We want your ideas to fuel this podcast, so don't be shy.
Thanks for joining us on Reading the Grid. Keep your engines running and your pages turning. Until next time.